I'm Andrew Schwartz, and you're listening to The Truth of the Matter, a podcast by CSIS where we break down the top policy issues of the day and talk with the people that can help us best understand what's really going on. This is a special episode of The Truth of the Matter. It's actually an episode of the CSIS Smart Women, Smart Power podcast, which is hosted by my colleague, Kathleen McInnes. In this episode, Kathleen interviewed Representative Mikey Sherrill, a Democrat from New Jersey, about her career and her recent visit to the Munich Security Conference.
Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill has had a whirlwind past couple of weeks after returning from trips to the Munich Security Conference in Germany and the Middle East, including stops in Egypt, Jordan, and Israel, sponsoring the recently passed House legislation aimed at protecting Americans from TikTok's national security threats. That's a lot. So we're honored to have Representative Sherrill on the podcast today to dive into these emerging and cutting-edge national security threats across the globe and at home. I'm Dr. Kathleen McInnes, and this is Smart Women, Smart Power. So welcome to the podcast, Representative Sherrill. We've got so much to cover, but of course, on Smart Women, Smart Power, we like to kick it off by hearing origin stories, like what got you into the field and why did you decide to run for Congress?
Great questions. So, you know, my grandfather was a pilot in World War II and was actually shot down over occupied France. And, you know, as a little girl, hearing his stories, but also understanding how much he, you know, loved serving in the military at times, and then also his just really great love of aviation inspired me. So when I was in about the fifth grade, I told my father I wanted to fly. And he said it was too expensive, that you had to go in the military if you wanted to fly. And I said, okay, well, I'll go, you know, I'll go to the Air Force Academy. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, that's kind of a newer one. I don't know when that started. He said, you could go to one of the cool ones. You want to go to West Point or Navy. And I said, but I want to fly. And he goes, I think they fly in the Navy. And I said, okay, well, I'll go there. And this is really just a cautionary tale to all the parents listening, because this was fifth grade. And I can say with some certainty that my father was paying zero attention to this conversation and not actually thinking at that time that I was developing a plan for the rest of my life. So I did decide that I wanted to go to the Naval Academy and fly, and did eventually do that.
Shout out to Annapolis.
Went off to Annapolis, served for about 10 years afterwards, and really loved the sense of mission that came with a job in the military. And so kind of wanted a sense of mission, and really felt part of the reason I got out, among several different reasons, was my concern about torture and rendition and Guantanamo. And at that time, the one part of our government that seemed to really be weighing in on this in a way that I thought was important was the Supreme Court. So I decided to go to law school. I wanted to go become a lawyer, work on Guantanamo cases. I was told by a professor I very much respected, Neil Katyal, who had handled the Hamdan case, one of the Guantanamo cases. I said, you know, I want to go do that. And he kind of looked at me and said, really skeptically, well, you know, first you need to go learn how to practice law. So I went to a law firm. And after that, again, just kind of, like I said, really enjoying that sense of mission, went to work at the U.S. Attorney's Office. They were not hiring prosecutors at the time. So I started as an outreach and reentry person, really starting our district's first federal prisoner reentry court, and found I really thought that some of the way the criminal justice system impacted our communities was one of the greatest civil rights issues of our day, and decided to actually leave the office and work on criminal justice reform when, you know, some of how Trump was governing became apparent with the Muslim ban. And I guess I would say he was actually governing like he had run his presidential campaign, which in my mind was really an attack on a lot of the values I had stood for my entire life. And so I decided to run for Congress. That was a weird decision in some cases, because I have four kids. So I remember when people in my neighborhood were sort of encouraging me to do it, other moms at my kids' school. And I said, they said, you should run for Congress. And I said, well, no, I shouldn't. I have four kids. This is a bad idea.
But I thought like, about as a mother of two kids, I'm like,
it's a bad idea, right? Like, it's a really bad idea.
Like, I could barely get myself out of bed without like 15 cups of coffee. Like,
exactly. And I think my husband has this sneaking suspicion that I'm in Congress because sometimes I need a break from four kids, which is not true.
Although that resonates just a little.
Yeah, I know. My daughter thinks so too. I am roommates with Abigail Spanberger, and my daughter thinks we are like running some sort of sorority house. I'm like, Maggie, seriously, it's not that fun. So I went to my husband and kind of sheepishly said, because when you've served this country for most of your life and you start to feel as if there's a huge crisis going on in our government, and then you realize that you actually do have the capacity to run. And it's a kind of unique thing. I could run for Congress, and I wish it was easier for people because I worry that our Congress is almost becoming a more elite organization, but I could run for Congress because, quite frankly, my husband could kind of float me, right? Like, he could pay the mortgage while I was running for over a year. Because of my time at the U.S. Attorney's Office, had connections in our state with our state organization. Because of my time in the military, knew people down in Washington. They were mostly Republicans, but knew people down in Washington that to ask, how do you do this? And so as I started to feel like I could do it, then that's when I was raised Catholic, and that's when my Catholic guilt kicked in. And started to feel like, well, if I could do it, I should do it. I had a responsibility to do it. And I sheepishly went to my husband and said, Jason, I think I have to run for Congress, kind of expecting him to reflect my own realization that with four kids, I shouldn't. And he said, yeah, I think you should. Right.
Wow.
I don't think your listeners can maybe see the video. I can see your face. Like, what the heck? That was my face.
But it's awesome allyship, right? Like, yes, you can do this. Absolutely.
Right. And he is wonderful. Cause I will frankly say, if the shoe was on the other foot and Jason had come to me and said, I think I have to run for Congress, I would have said, you don't, you really don't have to do that. So yes. So then we were sort of off to the races.
You just recently returned from a trip where you engaged in, with our allies and partners and visited some of these very difficult hotspots. What were your biggest takeaways from the trip?
I guess a couple takeaways. I'm trying to think of how to be concise, but the one takeaway is when you go to, I was at the Munich Security Conference, which is just probably the major defense conference in the world.
Absolutely.
And
it's like defense palooza.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. It's kind of a weird thing that you go into the Hof, which is this old hotel. And I guess they tried to move it at one point, but it has been in the Hof forever and everyone threw a fit. So it's this kind of crowded, not well ventilated, old German hotel. And there's an American room where people from the congressional delegation, for example, you can just go in there and get coffee and stuff and meet with reporters or different people. And then upstairs, you have the delegation room where you meet with foreign leaders. But you're just kind of walking through this hall, and you can walk right past people like Hillary Clinton, which I did, in a sort of hallway in this old German hotel. And you can see, the leaders of different nations and the foreign ministers, and you see many U.S. generals are there, and former U.S. generals. So it's really a very interesting place. But I went there, and it was kind of a rushed thing because we were trying to get there early and votes got canceled. Mike Turner, who was leading the delegation, is the chair of the Intelligence Committee. And he was, really seeing if Mike Johnson, the speaker, could wrap it up so we could get out there, because we were going to be on the ground a very short time. So we ended up at the last minute, almost. It felt like I was rushing home because I was sort of half packed. So we're rushing out the door. We get on the flight. We go there. We get up the next morning, go to the security conference. And almost the first thing I heard, there were rumors that Navalny had died. And so you sort of come there, and as we went, and part of the reason we were going there is because they do these talks like Germany in the world, France in the world. They were doing the U.S. in the world, and that was given by the vice president. So we were we were going to see that. So I'd heard Navalny was killed by someone from the BBC and was still, you know, processing that and trying to get details on it. And then we sat down in the auditorium, which again, to give you kind of the sense of this old hotel, it looks like a ballroom and there are balconies along the side. And you get a sense that in a different era, you know, there people hosted those kind of Regency dance, you know, balls and stuff. And so we sit there and the vice president gives her speech and they said, please remain seated. And Navalny's wife got up and she had just heard the news. And I think she was still hoping against hope it wasn't true. And she got up and spoke about it. So you're just getting this very deep understanding to me, given that we were at the Munich Security Conference, that we were in Europe. To me, it was just a reminder of exactly why the Ukrainians are sacrificing so much to remain free. Because there was no better, I think, way of understanding what life under Putin looks like and how dangerous it is for anyone who doesn't want to simply, you know, kind of bow their head and do whatever he says. So it was really moving and horrible. We went to see Zelensky later on in the conference. And, you know, I've met with him several times. I have a large Ukrainian American community. Zelensky's been frustrated with the United States at different occasions. I remember when I first met him, the reason I went out to Ukraine, and this was right before Russia invaded, and you know, it was so close to what we thought was going to be Russia's invasion that the Armed Services Committee was telling me, look, we'll get you out if we can, but if he falls, you're going to have to go out this route. It's going to be a land route, flights, you know, they'll probably bomb the airports first thing. So, you know, we had a whole plan of evacuation. That's how close we thought the possible invasion was and how likely we thought it was. But I was hearing that Zelensky was saying it wasn't likely and stuff. So that's why I went over there, because I, you know, we were trying to understand what was going on, where the disconnect was, if he knew something we didn't. And when we spoke to him, he was frustrated because the talk of war was crashing the Ukrainian economy. And so I think he understood what we understood, but he was also worried that without one shot fired, Russia was winning. But he was very frustrated with us and saying, you know, it's costing me this, you know, how are we going to go forward? What are you doing? And so he's very frustrated with the United States, but, you know, I think knew what was coming and thoughtful and stuff. So we spoke to him then. The next time I spoke to him, I went back, and this was during the war. You know, the war had commenced, and we went to speak to Zelensky. And I think, you know, he was, again, a little frustrated, like, come on, you know, we're trying to fight this war. Why won't you give us these certain weapons? Why are you withholding, you know, you're in or you're out kind of thing. And so it was interesting to me because we went to speak to Zelensky at the Munich Security Conference, and I expected more of this, you know, I expected, like, because he's an advocate for his country, but instead he just was resolute. He just said, we're going to keep fighting. You know, we're going to win this. We're going to do this. We need your support, but we're going to do it. And
right.
They
don't have a choice. When I was in Ukraine in August, you know, one of the people I spoke with said, there's fates worse than death. Russia winning. It's a genocidal war strategy. They really, truly don't have a choice but to continue fighting.
And they've seen firsthand why that is. They've seen firsthand what the towns look like that Russia has overtaken.
Absolutely.
They know the brutality of the forces. I mean, Russia's been pulling their forces from prisons. They know what's happening.
War crimes are like the way of war.
Kidnapped. Yes, yes. It's horrible. So that was just really humbling. And if we can't do this, I think there's an argument for why do we have NATO? If we can't lead NATO in this time, you know, I think one of our greatest diplomatic achievements, ending the constant cycle of war in Europe that led to world wars. If we can't lead in this moment, then, you know, why do we have NATO? If we can't come together with our allies and support democracy against one of the world's major adversaries of the United States, it really begs the question at that point.
Can I ask your thoughts, you know, the likelihood of some sort of aid package being passed? I mean, there's so much urgency from the Ukrainian side. Obviously, national security folks we're all deeply worried. I'd be very curious your perspective sitting in the hot seat. if you think it's likely to occur?
I don't know if likely is the word, but I'm not going to give up until it occurs. I guess there's the old military saying, find a way or make one. And that's kind of where we're at now. So we're trying with every lever we have to get this done. We have put a Democratic discharge petition on the floor. I remember Hakeem Jeffries at Munich saying, I did not expect to come and be asked by European allies about a discharge petition. So we're putting that on the floor. And so we have to get 218 signed on to the discharge petition. We now have 180 Democrats. We have no Republicans, which is really disappointing because, you know, we have Republicans who claim to be incredible supporters of Ukraine, and yet not one of them is on this discharge petition, which is just the Senate bill, the very bipartisan Senate bill, which has been negotiated, has been on the table for months. I mean, this was the plan, I think, in August. It's not new. It's not different. It's what I think most Republicans say they support. And yet not one has gotten on. Even members of the Republican conference who aren't running for reelection haven't gotten on the discharge petition, which is odd. And I think they keep sort of saying that Speaker Johnson has a plan. And yet the plan seems to keep getting kicked down the road. The latest is we'll do this after the break, you know, as members go home for their district work week. But I was just talking to Hakeem Jeffries yesterday saying, look, you know, every minute, every hour, this is really snowballing. It's not as if we pass this, get it to the president, he signs it, and suddenly, you know, we release all the weapons. I mean, much of this money goes to our munitions supply base to get the factories rolling.
An American industrial base. It's American factories.
American factories, yes. And that, you can't turn that around on a dime. So we've really got to get this done. And waiting another 2 weeks is really, really not helping the problem. And especially when we have the Senate bill on the floor, let's just get it done. People keep saying they're supporting, and yet, you know, I think Republicans really need to kind of put their money where their mouth is and start moving this forward.
Well, speaking of an issue where there has been bipartisan consensus, I mean, the protecting Americans from foreign adversary, the TikTok bill, yes, which you supported. Yes. So yeah. Could you explain to us why should Americans care about this bill? Why should we care about TikTok ownership?
You know, I think we should care about it on so many levels, but this bill in particular, one of the reasons I think Americans should care about it is because it shows that even in the most partisan, difficult times, that Congress can come together around important issues and function. So while certainly it's frustrating that it is now March and we still haven't passed this year's budget, it does seem as if we're going to get that done this week. I'm knocking on wood. We just passed half of it.
Fingers crossed. Yeah.
By the end of the week, I may be here over the weekend, which isn't great, but nevertheless, I'm really hoping that we can get that done, and I'm feeling fairly positive about it. We were able to pay our nation's debts, even though extremists said they wouldn't allow that to happen. So Congress is functioning. It's not pretty. I'm not sure legislation has ever been pretty, this less so than normal, but we are continuing to make our government work because there are people here that care deeply about this country and the American people and want to continue to engage in our democratic practices in an important way. So that is all to say that the TikTok bill to me is an example of that. We saw the Senate attempt to pass this in the Restrict Act, a similar bill. And we saw that almost immediately TikTok spent hundreds of millions of dollars lobbying against it and killed the bill.
Right.
Which, you know, I think a lot of people think, oh, Congress can't function. They're so beholden to corporate interests, et cetera. And obviously that was an example of the difficulty in functioning in that way. However, I'm on the new special committee for strategic competition with the Chinese Communist Party. And that committee, I was told when I was asked to join it, I said, well, is this a serious committee? You know, I'm really not, you know, four kids, two dogs. I'm not down in Congress so I can, like, you know, as I would say to my kids, dork around. Like, I got stuff to do. I want to get stuff done. I want to deliver for New Jersey. So when I was asked to be on the committee, I said, I don't need a committee where we're going to fight over who's tougher on China. You know, I want to do real things. And I was assured that it would be a bipartisan, thoughtful committee. And it certainly has been. I have nothing but praise for the work of the committee. And so the committee got to work in the aftermath of the Senate bill failing and just started looking at the constitutional issues, how we could best do a divestment, the intelligence briefings on why this was so important, and quietly just did the work of Congress. Not a lot of information on social media or crowing about how important the work was or how great the committee was doing, but just really quietly went to work to draft legislation that is so important. And I can't praise the professional staff of the committee enough for the hard work they did month after month after month without, you know, a lot of praise, just kind of got to work and delivered this bill, then put it in the Energy and Commerce Committee, gave them the bill, had the intelligence briefings all teed up, had everyone go to the intelligence briefing so people could understand really clearly exactly what the threat was. They came out of that. I think TikTok helped a little because they, in claiming that they couldn't influence anyone, then influenced everyone on TikTok to call their Congress, you know, geolocated them to call their congressperson and shut their thing down and showed the power.
Mm-hmm. I think in soccer, they call that an own goal.
Yes, yes, exactly. And to the point where then we got a 50-0 vote out of the Energy and Commerce Committee.
That's astonishing.
Really is astonishing and shows how, you know, there are thoughtful, hardworking people here that can really focus in on what's important for the country and less about what's kind of good for their reelection.
Right. My understanding, because people usually look at TikTok for cat videos and recipes, right? But the problem is that if you have messages that are counter to Chinese intentions, narratives, messages.
Shadow banned. And we even had someone banned in my state. A woman who was putting TikTok information up about the Uyghur genocide was banned from TikTok for a while. But what they do, as well as what's called shadow banning, so the algorithms used don't put your information into most feeds. So things about the Uyghur genocide, Tiananmen Square, Hong Kong, and how they failed in their promises to Hong Kong, all of that is shadow banned. So you won't see information on that like you would see on other similar platforms like Reels. So you can see the difference very clearly. And so it's really shutting down, I think, free discourse in that way. It's also a real problem for the freedom of association, for example, because they've used the TikTok app to trace certain reporters from BuzzFeed and Financial Times who were meeting whistleblowers that the Chinese did not want to have them talking about certain issues. So they found, you know, where the meeting took place. They just geotagged everyone and figured out who they met with so they could track down the whistleblower. It's really concerning what they have. They also have access to so much U.S. Private data. And in a 2017 law in communist China, TikTok has to provide information to the Communist Party that they have on demand. And we certainly know what China's done with that information at certain times and know that on demand, TikTok and the parent company ByteDance would have to provide all this U.S. information to the Communist Party. So it's become very concerning. I know the chair of China Competition Committee, Mike Gallagher, and the ranking member, Raja Krishnamoorthy, both were in Taiwan shortly after the elections there, and the Taiwanese were showing them how much TikTok had worked to influence their election. So certainly with an election of our own coming up in November, it's important that we move quickly. We've seen, and President, you know, former President Trump obviously knows this because he was all for banning TikTok and then met with one of his major donors who was invested in TikTok and now has walked that back. So he obviously is no stranger to using foreign adversaries to influence our election or attempt to influence our election. So I think, you know, there are real concerns we have here, which is likely in part why you saw that 50-0 vote and why you saw an overwhelming vote on the floor.
Well, it's just sort of like, you know, we're reluctant to give our private information to Target or like to, you know, we have concerns about privacy of, you know, American government invasions of certain surveillance and all that sort of stuff. So maybe we shouldn't just hand it in a bow to Beijing.
Exactly. Well, and we also have rules on foreign adversaries' ownership of media companies.
Right.
But those are a little dated because I don't think people have quite, legislators, I should say, have quite moved the understanding to the fact that so many people get their news now
right.
from these feeds as well. And we have CFIUS rules, which, you know, if you have a sale to a foreign adversary that triggers a lot of privacy implications, you can force that sale. So we saw that with Grindr, for example. It was a U.S. company sold to a Chinese company with tons of U.S. citizens' data. So CFIUS came in and said, no, that's not appropriate. We need to protect this data. And they forced a sale back. With TikTok, it didn't trigger CFIUS because it wasn't originally a U.S. company. So forced sales, you know, are actually not new. Concerns about media in foreign adversaries' hands, not new. This just was a somewhat unique thing. So this bill is actually broader than just TikTok. You know, kind of it fills that hole in our legislation, but it does implicate, you know, TikTok specifically as well.
Representative Cheryl, you have been so generous with your time. If I could just ask you for your thoughts on two questions to wrap
sure.
us up. Okay, one is, do you think that your gender as a woman has impacted how you approach these issues and take decisions? And if so, why? And if not, why not?
You know, I do. I think that being a woman is just complicated. That, you know, it's funny. I have two sons and two daughters. And sometimes my husband has said to me, he grew up in a family of two boys. I grew up in a family of three girls. So it's kind of different. But he's sometimes said to me, why are our girls so difficult? And I said, you know, they're not difficult. They're complicated. It's a difference. And I think that stems from so many things, but certainly it stems from the fact that I thought that in my career, my husband and I would always be 50-50 partners. And yet I was the one who got pregnant. I was the one who took maternity leave. I was the one who was breastfeeding, you know, that just, and so then I was the one who was trying to hunt down childcare, which was very, very difficult.
Childcare.
You know, there's just so many complexities to being a woman, especially a woman in the workforce and how that works. And then there's still a lot of misogyny throughout different systems. So when I was at the Naval Academy, I remember a woman standing up and saying to Admiral Kelso, who was a submariner and the chief of naval operations, when will women be submariners? And to a standing ovation of the brigade of midshipmen, he replied, not in my lifetime.
Wow.
There's an article in Naval Proceedings that would go around the Naval Academy when I was there by James Webb entitled Women Can't Fight. So, you know, I think being a woman in the workplace, and there's a voting bell, being a woman in the workplace, I think breeds empathy too for being judged by things you can't control unfairly. But I think that also gives you empathy for other people who aren't like you. And yeah. And a desire to maybe understand more broadly different people and a feeling, I certainly have, that different people and different voices make organizations stronger. So I think there's just a lot of complexity, whether it's the workplace and your home life or dealing with inequity that women bring to the job in a way that's different.
Yeah. Well, and then to conclude our conversation, I'd love your thoughts on, especially given this work you've been doing and the issues and your inspiration, what are your thoughts of what is power?
I guess at its most basic form, power is the ability to get things done that you want to get done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably a broad definition. So narrowly, what I think of as power is, because of my life choices, the power to get things done for the people I serve. So whether that, you know, whether those are people that I, you know, when you're a leader, you're kind of serving people as much as anyone. So the men and women who I was leading in the Navy, who I felt I served, you know, making sure that they were taken care of was important to me. At the U.S. Attorney's Office, making sure that I was doing everything in my power to create a more fair system. And now in the United States House of Representatives, serving the people of my district and of New Jersey, when I can affect change in people's lives, Congress can be a little bit attenuated. Sometimes we pass these laws, you know, sometimes we get like the Gateway Tunnel funded. And guess what? In 10 years, there's going to be a Gateway Tunnel. You know, sometimes people don't actually feel the impact on their lives right away. So when I can deliver something right away that really impacts people's day-to-day lives, that to me is the gold standard. Even if it's just You know, we had a call the other day from a veteran in my district who was concerned about his buddy because he thought his buddy was contemplating suicide. And he texted me, he said, you know, I've already lost too many friends. And so his friend had been in inpatient care, but had been out of inpatient, you know, was out of inpatient care, and it was going to take him 6 weeks to get into treatment, which I think everyone understands to be far too long. So we went to work, and I have to say, Congressman Ro Khanna's office was fantastic in helping us get this service member the help he needed. And that kind of stuff feels great when you can directly impact people's lives.
Delivering on service. Well, thank you so much, Representative Scherr. You've been so generous with your time, and what a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for sharing your insights about Munich and TikTok and what brought you to Congress.
Well, thank you so much. I love this podcast, and this was a great conversation. Thanks again.
If you enjoyed this podcast, check out our larger suite of CSIS podcasts, from Into Africa, The Asia Chessboard, China Power, AIDS 2020, The Trade Guys, Smart Women, Smart Power, and more. You can listen to them all on major streaming platforms like iTunes and Spotify. Visit csis.org/podcasts to see our full catalog.